unusual the thing about the story of the first sin of the Chet of Adam. In a general kind of a sense, two accounts, as you know, there's two accounts of creation. There's one of the first account, and then the Torah goes back and brings out certain details that it didn't mention in the first account. Now, the clearest right for that is what? The fact that there's two accounts. The clearest proof is there's a difference. In the first account, it would appear that the man and woman were created simultaneously. And because there it's just talking about the results of the creation. You know, what was created in the first day, what was created in the second day. It's not interested in any of the processes. It's just what God brought into existence. So when it comes to the description of the humans, it would appear that male and female, I mean, God created them, the human, the Talmud with him, male and female. Then it goes back and it covers the ground. It goes into certain, we find out that the man and woman, for example, were not created simultaneously. That begins, I believe, in chapter 2, Pasuk Tezvav, where it says that God took the man and placed him in the Gan Eden. Alright, La'avdo L'shamra, to guard it and to work it. Apparently there was some type of work that was required on his part. Even though, by and large, the condition in which he existed is completely different. That's one of the elements. Let me ask you at this point, what is the first thing that would strike you about the story of the sin? Why is this sin different? Why is this sin different than all other sins? Because of the sin was, there'll be, yes, that's the essence of all sin. That's the first thing, and that's, I'm glad you mentioned that. It would not strike us, eating from this fruit or that fruit wouldn't strike us. That's because we're operating with our own concept of good and bad. We always have to be aware of that we have a certainly made concept of good and bad, and that is not necessarily what the Torah regards as good and bad. What the Torah regards as good and bad is to live in conformity with the will of God. That is good. And anything which is bad is because it's not in conformity with the will of God. No matter how it strikes you, it's irrelevant. That's why there's a wide divergence. And many of the things, for example, flicking on a light on Shabbos does not strike one as being evil. And yet, that is one of the greatest evils that a person could do. So therefore, you know, our concept of what is good and what is bad has nothing to do with what our emotions dictate to us. It's interesting, I was just thinking of the passage everyone always quotes it, you know, in Mishlei. There's the Torah Chesed al Hashonah. You know, speaking about the Eishes Chayil, so referring to her chesed, compassion. So it says the Torah of chesed, al Hashonah. The Torah of chesed is on her lips. What does that mean? Praising her for her chesed. Now that's not the way, that is not the way the ordinary person would praise someone who's compassionate. Why? Because it shows you a very, it may be just a nuance, but it shows you a major difference. See, it's not the fact that a person engages in acts of chesed, but they can be, people have certain emotions, so the acts of chesed, the compassion, can be dictated by certain emotions. The inyad is the perfection, it's Torah, it's a totally different kind of a chesed, it's a Torah of chesed. In other words, it's based on wisdom. A person just acts compassionately out of their own emotions. Who says it's compassion? Who says it's good? And people can do the craziest things out of these emotions. So it can produce the greatest evils. So that's not what we're praising. We're praising chesed is a Torah. It's knowledge. You have to have knowledge, you have to have wisdom, you have to have understanding. So it shows that our system is completely different. The essence of this chesed is the violation of the Tzivi Hashem, and the consequences are very great. Very great consequences. But what makes it unique in terms of the Torah is that what? What makes a difference is that this sin is part of the story of creation. And that's not really where one would think it ought to to be. Because the Torah is basically divided into two sections. There's the story of the creation. That creation is one idea. That's one idea. Then there's history. What happens to man afterwards? After, now that man has been created and, you know, he proceeds in the course of his, so the Torah records what happened. The Torah is not a history book. Its objective is not history. But in the course of its objective, it does include certain things that happened historically. You would think that the story of the sin is part of the history, like other sins are recorded there. For example, the sin of the flood, the model, and so forth. This is incorporated into the story of creation. That's what makes it unique. That's one of the unique characteristics. Also, we know that it's different than other sins. It's different than other sins in another significant respect. What's that? Well, this is related to the thing I said before, that it effectuates, this sin is responsible for a complete change in the nature of the existence, of human existence, in terms of man himself. A profound change in the nature of human existence in two respects. What are the two respects? Stories like this. Basically, a person, you read about a subsequent case where a person sins. Of course, every sin has an effect upon a person. So he's punished, or he does tshuva, or whatever. But he essentially remains the same person. It's not a new bria. You change in terms of the state of existence. He's no longer living in Gan Eden. A Gan Eden is not just a place. It's a whole way of existence. It's a whole way of life. And also, there's another change that occurs. Being himself changes. You take a look at the story, you'll see clearly as soon as he partakes of the forbidden, immediately there's a change. He knows that he's naked. That's very significant. In other words, pre the sin, he did not have any necessity for clothing. And we don't understand that. And as soon as he commits the sin, he has a need for clothing. Shame. So that, those two things indicate that, again, another element in which this thing is different. Let's take a look at what happens over here. From Tezvav and on. It says that God took from the man, Vayikach Hashem Elokim et Adam, Vayanichehu B'gan Eden Liyadu L'Shama. Right. Now, Vayitzav Ad Hashem Elokim Al Adam Baymor. Here's the first mitzvah. God commanded the man, saying, Mikol Eit Hagan Achol Tochel. From all of the fruits of the garden you may eat. From Eit Hadas Tovara, and from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, well, Tochal Menu, you can't eat from it. Kiviyam Acholchal Menu, most Tomas, because on the day that you eat from it, you will die. And what's important about this pasuk is, what does it mean, Eit Hadas, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? What kind of a tree is that? Only the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Okay. The Rambam explains. We're going to be doing this. We're not going to cover the whole thing today, but we're going to be doing it through the explanation that's given by the Rambam in the Mora. If you want to look ahead to tomorrow, let's just see if we can establish the foundations today. Then, Vayomer Hashem, also we may ask, well, what is the purpose of this mitzvah? What's the purpose? What is the reason? Is this, what kind of a mitzvah? What kind of a mitzvah is this? We know that there are different kinds of mitzvahs. We divide the mitzvahs into basically chukim and mishpatim. Right? The chok, mishpatim are those mitzvahs ordinances where the logic is pretty self-evident. You know, you can't steal. Laws pertaining to... it's wrong to use the term rational laws, because all the laws are rational. Hukam are rational too. We just, they're not obvious. The rationality is something which is not obvious on the surface. So, but if one were to probe, if you know, had to probe to the underlying ideas, the deeper ideas, they're hidden. There's a hidden idea. So then the and you would discover that idea. You see that it's perfectly rational. Okay. Now something else. Vayomer Hashem Elokim, and God said, Lo tov hayos adam levado. It is not good for the man to be alone. Efer lo ezer kenegdo. I will make for him a ezer, a helper, kenegdo, alongside of him to help him. Okay. That's the question I want you to ask at this point. Of course, God knew all of this in advance, so then why create the man and then say that something is lacking, apparently? It's not good, right? And then create the woman. If that's the case, what you're saying basically is that the man needs a woman, and that's why I'm going to create the woman. So then they should have been created simultaneously. Right, then we have an interesting digression. Then God, it says that God had created all of the animals of the field and the birds of the heavens, and God brought them to the man to see what he would call them. And everything that the man called Nefesh Chaya Hushimo, that was his name. Okay, what question should we ask for this? Well, what was the point of bringing them to, you know, it's funny. What is this, like bringing the animal to the man to give it a name? What's the point of all that, right? What was the purpose of such a thing? I mean, God could have, I would imagine that God is the creator, so then God should give the name. But what's the purpose of having a name altogether? Why is it necessary even, what's the necessity of all this endeavor? And this can't be trivial stuff. There's got to be something really important going on over here. By the way, it does, if this is what you're getting at, it seems to be disjointed, because first God says that it's not good for the man to be alone, and God is going to create an Ezer Kenegdo. You would have thought that the next thing would be the creation of the Ezer Kenegdo. And then no, then it seems like there's a digression, you know, the business of the naming of the animals now comes into the picture. So it seems a little bit out of order. I think Ben has made a very good observation. Well, it doesn't say that God said this to Adam. It means that God doesn't speak, obviously. It means that the Torah is pointing out that God took cognizance, so to speak, of this fact, that this was part of God's plan to prepare for him in Ezer Kenegdo. But not that he told this to Adam. And I think you're trying to say that once Adam knew that he'd be relating to an Ezer Kenegdo, so then this is some type of a preparation for that, a training, to be concerned with the needs of others. It's a nice drasha, but I don't think that's the plain idea. Okay, we're trying to get to the, you know, not to the drushes of the Torah, but to the basic ideas. Alright, so then it says, Vayikra Adam Shemot. And he called, he gave names to all of the animals and the birds and all the wild beasts. And then it repeats, Uli Adam lo mata Ezer Kenegdo. And for Adam, he had not found an Ezer Kenegdo. Which seems to be a bit, of course he hadn't. Where was he supposed to find one? What are we talking about? where was he supposed to find one? Doesn't make sense on the surface. The implication is that this endeavor of the naming had something to do with the search. There was some kind of a search going on for an Ezer Kenegdo. For it says, "Will the Adam Loma to Ezer Kenegdo." Okay, so that again is another issue. What do you mean? It doesn't make sense. Of course, we know he hadn't found one because there was none in existence. That's the question. Take a look at Rashi and Chafu. Adam Loma to Ezer. Kishayvion. When he brought the animals, Hevian Lafanav, Kol Min V'Min, he brought each species, Zachar and Keva, male and female, Amar, he said, "Lekulam yesh ben zug." Every one of them has a ben zug. Beli ain ben zug, and I don't have a ben zug. I don't have a mate. Miyad vayapel. That seems to be what you're basing yourself on. No?
Yeah, I didn't decide to build
one. Yeah, but that's not so simple. I mean, I don't take that at face value. It doesn't make enough sense to me. I don't understand it. Because the question, my question would be, if that deficiency is there, if he needs a, if it's not good to be alone, so I don't think that the fact that he notices that the animals have a mate, each animal has a mate, I don't see that this is really so important, that this is going to make him aware of what he's lacking. Okay. Chazal, however, say that he brought, as we'll see, he brought forth the animals and that he had sexual relations with all the animals. And he couldn't be satisfied. Chazal do say that. Gimel. Then it says that God put him into a deep sleep. Right? And he took one of his ribs and then he, he closed the flesh beneath it. And then he built the selah, the rib, that he took from the man into a woman, and he brought her to the man. Vayomer ha'adam, and the man said, Zos ha'pam, etzemeh, so this is the one. Et bone of my bone, basar of psari. Here's an explanation. This pasuk is giving us an explanation as to what caused the relationship to work. Etzemeh, samayo basar of psari. Zos yikara isha. This shall be called Isha, ki me ish lukachazot, because from man this one was taken. Here's where Rashi says, "The Rashi zosapam." This time, no, this time it's good. Malami shabo adam al kol behema v'chaya. This teaches us that he had relations with all the animals, lonis kara daito, and he was only satisfied ela b'chava. So, what do you see from this? What's the Chazal? Well, he wasn't emotionally fulfilled. This is a very important point. Very important point, and the Chazal are making a point over here. Let's pause then and understand this. This will tie everything together. And will explain to us the key question over here. This is the key question. And that is, see, above and beyond everything we're doing lies this question. The main question, I would say, at this point is, why was there a change in the plan of creation? With regard to the basic plan of creation, male and female were created simultaneously, except in the human species. By the case of the human species, they were not created simultaneously. First, the man was created, and the man embarked upon certain activities of naming and so forth, and he got to see. And then the woman was created. And the woman, when she was created from the man. Okay? So let's pause now. Let's see if we can answer that. That will be the first foundation. What we're saying is that the point is not to be understood that the original intention was for man to live alone. That man would not need a mate. That's not the case. That was true from the very beginning. But the manner in which this being had to come into existence had to be different due to the specific nature of man, of Adam. And that's what we're trying to explain. And it's in the Pesukim right here. Back to the creation of the Bria. If you want to understand, understand something about the Bria, go back to the Bria itself. And the answer should be, in the ascent, there is a, what we see is like this, is that there's some type of a relationship between man and the animals. You see they're both created on the same day, interestingly enough. Right? There's some commonality, and yet there's a key difference. Both of them have mates, male and female, created to them, applies to both, but yet there's a difference. So the answer would lie in some element. The answer would lie in some element in their nature. So go back to the actual creation. Perek Aleph, Pasuk Chav Dalet, talks about the, that's the sixth day of creation. And there's two phases, two creations are brought forth on that day. First you have the animal life, instinctual life. Totsi Aretz Nefesh Chaya Lamina, Nefesh Chaya. That's the subject matter of that day is Nefesh Chaya. Now Nefesh Chaya includes two different species. One is Nefesh Chaya Behema V'Remes V'Chai Saret Lamina. And Vayasol Kenes Chaya Saret Lamina V'Yasa Behema Lamina V'Yas Kol Remes Adam Alaminehu Vayarokim Kito. That's Vayalakim Kitov usually comes at the end of a unit of creation. Here it comes sort of in the middle, because the work of creation for that day is not finished. Then Vayomel is the same day. What's interesting why this is all on one day. The day is not over yet, which means to say that the creation is not complete. Then Vayomel Okem Nasa Adam B'talmeinu Kidmusenu. Now we'll make Adam. B'talmeinu in our image, Kidmusenu, according to our form, which is of course, God has no form, God has no image. It's a reference to the what? To the Talmud Elohim, to the soul, to that capacity of man, which is to perceive knowledge, ideas, we refer to as the soul.
Well, you don't see that.
Soul is a reflection of a different being, which is of course infinitely superior, but something of a reflection because it's I have the capacity to partake of the world of ideas which is completely outside of the physical. That's what the soul means. But not in any way to have any type of thought that there's anything physical there, any type of what we regard as a form or an image. Gibral Kimasa Adam Salma. The Salmo Kim Bar Oso, Zakhar Kim Bar Osam. Ayvarak Osama Lakim Bayam Lakim Puruvu. Umilu Asarat Vikib Shua. Okay, so what do we see from this? They were both created on the same day. Does not seem to be a separate creation. It does say Vayivra Elohim es Adam. It does say Vayivra Elohim es Adam.
So that's referring to universal man. That's
the specific man. The specific man, of course. Well, he is the universal man, but he's a specific individual.
Mm-hmm.
So how would you say, let's get back to the point here. What do we see from this in terms of, here it speaks about God creating male and female. So you see that the original plan definitely called for male and female. Except at this point we don't realize that the female is going to come into being in a different way. Now let's see if we can tie it all together. Man does share something in common with the animal kingdom, but man is referred to as Nefesh Chaya. Going back to the beginning of, on that day, when God said, let the earth bring forth Nefesh Chaya. Nefesh Chaya means animal life, instinctual life. And man is referred to when that, man has that designation. You take a look at Bays, in the second story, Bei Zion, where it talks about the creation of man, Bei Zion, Vayitzar Hashem Elokim Esa Adam, and God fashioned man, Ofer Min Hadama, dust from the earth, Vayitach Biyapav Nishmat Chayim, and blew into his nostrils the breath of life, Vayi Adam LeNefesh Chaya, and he was a Nefesh Chaya, instinctual. They have the same term. So on the one hand, man has the designation of Nefesh Chaya. But then there's another, but there's one thing that differentiates him. What differentiates man from the animals? The Tzelem Elokim. Okay? Okay. So what's the answer?
In other words, there's a very significant difference between... This difference, by the way, the fact, of course, that man has the Tzelem Elokim and the animals don't, effectuates tremendous difference even in terms of the instinctual. It's not to say that instinctually what you have is like this. You have instinctually man and the animal is the same instinctually, then superimposed you have the addition of the Tzelem Elokim and Adam. It's not the way it works. But the existence of the Tzelem Elokim and Adam means to say that the instinctual is going to operate in a completely different way. He effectuates a difference with regard to the instinctual functioning. The instincts of man, I mean, they essentially they're physical instincts. I don't mean to say that they're endowed with any type of mind. I know a lot of people like all of the poetry, you know, the Western tradition likes to glorify the instinctual side of man. We don't believe in glorifying the instinctual side of man. That's a lie. Because all of the, example, like all of the poetry and literature about love, to glorify love and so on and so forth, it's basically a sublimation of something which is instinctual. We don't take, it's a very fundamental difference between that. I mean, you can get caught up with this type of thing. Because it's a very pervasive element in the culture. One of the main themes of Western culture and all the novels and so on and so forth is about love. The whole world revolves around love. And the truth of the matter is that love is really nothing more than a sublimation or a glorification of something which at bottom, if you unravel it, is an instinctual phenomenon. If the instinct were removed, then there'd be no concept of love and so forth in poetry. People wouldn't get all worked up about it. The fuel is an instinctual thing. Although people confuse themselves, they make it into an ideal with mass music. I'm talking about romantic love. Now, with regard to the animals, male and female were created simultaneously because the nature of their mating is purely instinctual. Since they are purely instinctual beings, so then the instincts are satisfied purely in an instinctual manner. So male is attracted to female, and that's all that's required. The instinct is satisfied purely by the existence of, I mean, it has to be the female, okay, of the species. And that's the way the instinct is structured. It's purely an instinctual affair. But Uli Adam lo matza eze kinegda means that man cannot function in the same way. It's due to the fact that man is a cellular kin, so he has a psyche, he has a psychological existence as well. Even with regard, and that psychological existence cannot be negated, even when we're talking about mundane affairs, even forget about the purpose of man. We're not talking here in terms of his purpose to develop a cellular kin, to perfect himself, to obtain knowledge and so forth. But it affects him even in terms of his instinctual life. His instinctual life is different than the instinctual life of the animal. That's why he couldn't be satisfied. He cannot be satisfied purely by an instinctual kind of a relationship. That's not how it works. You see that there has to be a psychological attraction as well. And that psychological attraction is based upon that etzame atzame, the realization that this person is like me. Comes from me, actually, which does teach you something. I mean, even when it comes to love, which is basically separating. You know, you're getting involved in somebody else, separating the energy from the self. Even there, it partakes of the self. It's a man essentially is a very selfish type of a being. You know, his image is very narcissistic, and that's what he found in the woman. He may ish the capacity to have a relationship with her was based on this very strong identification, and that's why it had to be in this way. And that's why he was not satisfied. Lo niskara daito, he could not be satisfied through any type of mating with the animal. Why? Because that was simply an instinctual thing. And man could not be satisfied, even on the instinctual level, by a relationship which was nothing more than instinctual. It had to be one which was able to satisfy his psychological makeup as well. And that explains why the woman had to be created in this way. And it wasn't just that she wasn't created simultaneously, but that she's intimately connected to him, and only in that way can he find satisfaction.
That's what the Chazal are telling us. The Chazal are telling us that he did have relay, he tried to satisfy himself. I understand it sounds difficult for us to take because we have already an ingrained impression, aversion to that type of thing. But bear in mind, as we will learn, Adam at this point in time was different. Pre the chait, he did not have certain emotions. He did not have certain emotions pre the chait, which came into being later on. So, let's put that issue aside and let's just ask ourselves, well, why couldn't he be satisfied? And the answer is because that couldn't relate to his psyche. So a relationship which could not relate to his psyche was not one which was satisfied. If his sexual need were purely an instinctual one, yes. But in man, the sexual need is sexual and psychological as well. You see, it is sexual and psychological. And if the psychological component is not satisfied, then it won't... Lotus Kara Daita is not going to... It's a good point. In other words, the underlying need that's being satisfied is more of a psychological phenomenon than purely instinctual. By the Tzelo Kim, we do not mean the psychological. But man does have a psychological makeup, and that the fact that he has that is because he is a creature who has a Tzelo Kim, but it is not to be identified one with the other. I am not saying that the psyche of man, the emotions of man, constitute his Tzelem Elokim. The Tzelem Elokim is that part of man which is capable of relating to abstract ideas and to form a relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. That's a different type of element. But man exists in a different manner. He has a psychological makeup. Okay? Now that is due to the fact that he's a being more than telemorphic. And the animals do not have such a makeup. They have purely an instinctual makeup. And as a result of the psychological, it was this factor which necessitated the separate creation of woman. Otherwise, he could not be connected to her. That's the pasuk of Etzemei Etzemei of Bas Mitzvari.
Now, after the... creation of the woman, Pasuk Kaf Dalet is interesting. It says, Al Ken Yazav Ish et Ovev V'yatimo. Therefore shall a man abandon his father and his mother. Of course, this is not Adam saying this. Pasuk Kaf Gimel, who's saying this? Pasuk Kaf Gimel says that the Adam said when he saw Chavos, This is the one, bone of my bone, flesh may of my flesh. This shall be called Isha, Kime Ishlu Tachadot. Then it says, therefore shall a man, Al Ken Yazav Ish, because of this shall a man abandon his father and his mother, the Davak be Ishto, and cling to his wife, for Hayu Lebasar Echad, and they shall become one flesh. Who said this? Was it Adam who said this? And if he did, what did he mean, abandon his father and mother? He didn't really have a father and mother. I don't think that would be the issue for him. It wouldn't make sense, correct? And to say it. Ruach HaKodesh from our king. This is not any individual. This is God telling us. God is making the point here. Of course, alright, so that wasn't Adam who said that. So it makes sense. The difficulty is, what's the point that is being made? That's the question. What's the point that's being made? And what is the relevance of making that, whatever point is being made, the Al-Kain? What does Al-Kain have to do with anything? Therefore always relates that. You can't begin an idea with therefore, I don't think. Right? Therefore, you can never get in front of a group and make a speech. Therefore, is always the conclusion. It presupposes that you've made some, you establish some premises, and then there's a therefore. There's an al-king. Here, if it was Adam who was saying it, perhaps perhaps we could, he's established it. He said that's an atomic, but maybe Al Kane would relate back to that. But you said we're saying it can't be Adam who's saying it, because he didn't have a father and a mother, so he's not the orphan. And Rashi confirms that it's not Adam. The Torah is making the point. So what is it therefore going back to? What is the point that's being made? And what shaykhet, what's the relevance, whatever that point is, why is this the precise place to make it? It's clearer. There seems to be a connection between Adam's proclamation, bones by bones, flesh by flesh, to shall be called woman. So whatever it means that we explained yesterday, that Adam's need for someone was satisfied with the woman because of the fact that she had come from him. And we explained why that had to be so. That was yesterday. Now the Torah is coming in with a new thought whose relevance we don't seem to understand. Therefore, shall a man abandon his father and mother? Seems to be coming out of nowhere. It has nothing to do with the subject. That wasn't what we were talking about. That wasn't the issue, at least where we understood it. Didn't seem to be the issue. So, and also, on a more specific basis, what is the concept of Al Kane? How do you start a sentence? What is it therefore relating? Therefore what? Therefore relates back to what? Because of what shall a man abandon? And why are we talking about a man abandoning his father and mother? What kind of an idea is that? So, it's a generalized, type of a question, like a cluster of questions come together here. Rashi does say what Eric is saying. Ruach HaKadosh Omeres Kane, the Torah is saying this. Blessed are all b'nei Noach Arayos, to prohibit the incestuous relationships to the b'nei Noach. In other words, if a man shall leave his father and mother. Yeah, but that's not the plain meaning, though. Okay? But you can't tell me. We have to understand the Torah, the narrative of the Torah, according to its plain shot. And plain shot, you can't translate it that way. That's what God is addressing us now, on the plain level, telling him not to engage in Arayos. Okay? It means, to be more specific, if that was the only purpose in this pasuk, I would not have been written. But the pasuk was written for a different purpose. And grafted, once the Torah writes, that's truto shel mikra, once the Torah is writing something, like many times Rashi will say, there's a deeper implication over here. The Torah has to say such and such, the blood of your brother cries out to me from the ground. So it's demay. So then it's written in the plural form to teach you a lesson that it's not just him, but you're responsible for all the... Yeah, but that is not the primary purpose. The primary purpose must be something intelligible, and given that it's there, so then the Torah will use it to add on and teach new ideas. You understand? So you have to understand what it means, what does it mean they'll become one flesh? I didn't mention that before, but that's part two. There are two ideas in this process. One is that he'll abandon his father and mother. The second part is v'hayi l'basar echad, and Avi is going along with Rashi, which means to say avlad, notes are ayidesh shneim, v'sham nasim nasa b'saram echad. Rashi takes that to mean the child. So your interpretation, according to Avi, the pasuk over here, the objective is the manner through which God will speak with that the species is being procreated. That's the Al-Kang. Okay? That's good. So Moshe's saying very good. He's positing that there is a necessity. There is a necessity for man to achieve a state of independence. Now again, where do we see? That's your question, Ellie. Where do we see? Yeah, let's go back to the text. Let's go back to the blueprint and see where we can find that such a need exists. No, but that is that the reason that's given for the creation is lo tov hayosa adam levado. Seems that whatever that means, we have a sense of it. It's not good for the man to be alone. He's not in a state of, he's not satisfied. There's a certain type of unhappiness in being alone. It's not, we didn't really delve into it exactly what it is, because it's more or less something that we relate to. And that is the reason that's given for the creation. Then the only question that we had was, so why didn't God provide the partner from the start? Why did it have to come from Adam? We went into that. Okay? But now the Torah is, Al-Kain is coming up with something. The problem over here is that now the Torah is throwing in something which it didn't tell us before. It seems. It seems that, oh, now that's the real purpose. So he should abandon his father and mother. But that's not the reason that necessitated the creation. It seems like now the Torah is coming with another reason. So we have to seek out the source, the root of that al-kain. Where does that go back to in the Torah? Or is it something new? In other words, does it exist already, the justification for the al-kain, or is something new? It's telling us about something new that's going to come into being, some future forms or whatever. For this, that for one reason or another, there's a concept of abandoning your father and your mother. There is such a concept in human existence to abandon one's father and mother. Okay? That's what we're trying to focus in on. It seems that to be Yahza love me, you know, is a part of the purpose. Now Avi's trying to say it's talking about procreation. That's where the necessity comes in. You could say that, but it seems a little bit more.
I think we should go back to the blueprint of creation, or to the creation of man in Perek Aleph. Well, Pasuk of Zion is the creation. Vayivra Elokim Eto Adam B'Talmo. And we did this yesterday. God created the man in his image. B'Talmo Elokim Bara Oso. Zachar Nekeva Bara Oso. Now go to Kav Ches, and even Kav Ches becomes a little bit difficult. Take a look at Kav Ches. The Pasuk of Ches, again, doesn't belong there. Where does it say by any other creature what it's supposed to do? We're interested, of course. Of course, we're interested in knowing. The information is very important to us, but why is it being told at this point? That should be told later on. Here we're just talking about creation. But included in creation is a blessing. Well, a blessing is that the appropriate place for a blessing? A blessing comes after. We're talking about the creation. Now, as a person proceeds through life, sometimes he needs a blessing. You see, before Yaakov died, he blessed his children. Before Moshe died, and so forth, he blessed. A person needs a blessing. Okay, there's a role, but here it's right. Including in the creation itself, he was created and blessed. And God, it says, and God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill up the earth and conquer it and gain dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds of the sky and all the animals that crawl on the earth. What is that? A blessing? What's the necessity for this blessing? What is it? What's the point that's being made over here? I mean, I wouldn't have a problem with it in general, but what I have a problem with it is the placement. Well, why is it being placed? It's part of the very act of creation. What does the blessing have to do with creation? Well, correctly points out, this is not the only case, but you have this. I believe it's only on the sixth day, because there the animals are created, right? It's only this idea of blessing is only with regard to the animals. That's the animals, am I right? Oh, you're right. Taninim. Those are it's a reference to the, it's on the fifth day. I'm wrong. It's on the fifth day. When God had finished creating the fish, the birds, the fish, and so forth. Yishvitzu Hamayim. Sheret Nefesh Chaya. See, on the fifth day, Nefesh Chaya is created on the fifth day and on the sixth day. There are two different branches of Nefesh Chaya. And God created the great big fishes, and all Nefesh Chaya Haromeset, which crawled on the earth, according to their species, and God blessed them and said, be fruitful and multiply. And here the blessing is a limited one. Here the blessing is a limited one. It's limited just to the being fruitful to reproduce. In Adam it goes beyond that. It's be fruitful, multiply, and something else. Okay? You know, the creation has a purpose, has a function. See? So their existence is incomplete unless their existence is incomplete unless they're fulfilling their purpose. Now, with regard to everything else, so the creation is divided.
into two different types of entity. With regard to certain types of entity, there's nothing really for them to do. They don't have any action to perform. The inanimate beings, when you're coming to the living beings, then there's a function. So the fulfillment of their function is part of their purpose. So that's the idea that God blessed them, that God, of course they don't have free will, you see, but they do have a function, and the function is to reproduce and to fill up the world. That's God's will, that the species should be propagated, be fruitful and multiply. Now, when it comes to Adam, let's examine it. Therefore, the blessing is appropriate. By Adam, it's different, because in Adam, it's much more difficult, so to speak, because here it's not just simply built into his instinct. To a certain extent, it is. To a certain extent, his purpose is built into his instinct, insofar as the fruitful and multiplied part. Because, you see, the entire world is fruitful and multiplied, doesn't just go to the mitzvah. You see, it's sort of an instinctual type of a thing. They're very powerful impulses. The entire world, I mean, overpopulation is more of a problem than underpopulation. So you see, it's an instinctual phenomenon. But there's a blessing there. And what is that blessing? It's tied in with another idea. What's the other idea? What's the purpose of the Puruvu Milues Art Dik Yeshua? There's the concept of man conquering, being a conqueror, gaining dominion. Scientific progress, building civilizations, and so on and so forth. All of this idea is what exactly has transpired over the course of that it's the will of God that man should not just be fruitful and multiply just to create more people. That there's a purpose to create civilizations and societies and to progress. Because you see that, Kirshua, conqueror, Uridu Begat Hayam, to gain dominion. Gain dominion means that man has to have the capacity to wage a battle with the forces of nature and to subdue nature and to conquer, to understand and so forth. All of this, and then you see later on, the Torah goes into the story of the development of civilization. He was the first one built the tools. He was the first one that built the city and so on and so forth. You see that concept that man, part of man's mission. The way in which progress comes about is basically that each generation breaks away from the parent generation and seeks to become independent on his own. In other words, in order for man to achieve his perfection in all realms, he's got to become independent. And the tendency of man is the way it is. One of the big problems psychologically that people do face, and you see it in people that have, even as adults, they still have these problems. They're trying to work out their childhood dependencies, because that's the way man is by nature. Because of all the creatures, man requires the longest period of development and dependency and so forth. His dependency, you see, in the animal kingdom, it doesn't take that long till the infants mature and they break away. Then they become completely independent. In fact, the instinctual brain, there's no relationship anymore. Once the cubs get older and they break away from the parent, I don't think they know each other anymore. They're like total strangers. There's no relationship whatsoever. In man, it's not just a physical, it's a psychological dependency. And that psychological dependency is a crippling thing. It makes it impossible for him to stand on his own two feet and become independent. But it's the will of God that a person should break away and achieve a psychological independence in order for him to. And each generation has to engage in its own battles. And that's part of the motivating factor. On the other end, there's a certain rebelliousness, so to speak. Which prompts people. That's how all scientific progress takes place. If the new generation comes along and they want to be better than the old one, and they do battle against them, and as a result of this battle, then they make new discoveries. You see, and the world progresses. Of course, then they become the establishment, and then the next generation comes along, and that's the way the whole it's built into the creation. But Al Ken Yazov, I believe, means that
in order to fulfill this purpose of true Ruv, that man should fulfill, each generation should not be dependent. If they're dependent, then they're not going to make progress. And they're not going to achieve their own purpose. I mean, on many levels, I'm talking in general terms now. I mean, we can isolate the particulars at a later date. But that's the Al-Kain. The Al-Kain is explaining the blueprint of creation, that in order to, there's a necessity for man. Of course, Adam HaRishon didn't have to break away from his father and mother. He was created in a different way, so his psyche was different. So his need, he still had a need of a woman. But in order for man to do so, to become independent, he can't be completely independent. He needs someone to whom he can attach himself. A substitute for his father and mother. A substitute for his father and mother. And that will be different. So in other words, from a psychological standpoint, the blueprint, you know, that's embedded in his unconscious and his psyche of whom he can relate to is basically determined by the parents, the parental image within him. So that's what he's seeking for, psychologically. So that's the woman who fulfills that purpose. He can break away and he can be independent, provided he has someone to whom he can turn to, which will fulfill that function, but it will fulfill it in a different manner. It will not fulfill it in the manner of a parent, he's just sustaining it, he's nurturing him, taking care of him, whom he's dependent upon. It's a helper. It's an aid or connector. So he's got to move from the state of dependency to independency, but in order to do so, he can't be levado. If he was levado, he wouldn't do it. So that's why he needs an Ezer Kenegdo. That's where the person comes in and tells us that's the fulfillment of the bracha. That's the fulfillment of the bracha of true Ruv. Because the bracha of true Ruv is more than just an instinctual phenomenon. You see, for man, for the animal, it doesn't require this type of an Ezer Kenegdo kind of a thing. It's an animal, it's purely an instinctual thing. So the blessing operates differently. But by man, it's a different type of a blessing. It's not just to be fruitful and multiply, but it's rather to become the master and to maintain, to become independent, and to become the custodian, so to speak, of civilization. To move on. You see? To take civilization one step forward. To keep the process going. So from that, he's got to be capable of abandoning Yaladim. It's very, very... It's not such an easy thing, on many, many levels. You see many people, you encounter many people that are capable of this, and you see many people that to a large extent are incapable of it. And, interestingly enough, the world at large, in general, you see that outside today, that it's not a general rule. You can't make rules over it because you're dealing, since man has free will, you'll always find exceptions. But by and large, you read a lot about the children that come from very powerful, successful parents. Always have tremendous problems. Because if the parent is too powerful, too awesome a figure, and as a type of personality, it really likes to be very demanding and authoritarian, so it becomes difficult. It sort of represses the independent impulses of the child. So therefore, the child feels whatever they do is meaningless, but that they'll never be able to outdo the parent. Part of the motivating factor is to outdo, to make a name for yourself, so to speak. These are emotions. So you see that element can be a curse, so to speak. Doesn't have to be, but it can be. But this is one of the main it can happen. The truth is, America was great teachers also, a very great intellectual leader doesn't always produce great things, because he's so overpowering that the students are just in awe of him, and they become dependent, they just think on their own. It requires a certain amount, not so simple. And sometimes another teacher or leader, whatever it is, that may not be that great intellectually, but is good, but encourages the students to, because he's not that intimidating. Okay? The important thing to remember for parents raising children, that the objective of the upbringing is to see that the emotion of the parent is to be nurturing and be protecting and so on and so forth, or whatever the case may be. Very often it masks the desire to have somebody dependent upon them. Although parents would never admit that. But the parents should be honest. But the objective, of course, is to nurture a being who's capable of being independent and standing on his own two feet and fulfilling his own, whatever his own, whatever that may be, whatever his own potential is. Each person has a potential. The tragedy is that many, that's why you need a brother, that many people do not fulfill their potential, what they really could be, because of their stifling, their certain emotional factors. And I'm not saying that there's many emotional, I'm not going to go all the factors, and I'm saying it all goes back, not only doesn't all go back to this, but this is pretty much of a result. That because of the nature of the situation, that the creature is so totally dependent upon his parents, and nurturing and upbringing for many, many years, it's a long process, and every time it's a long process with different stages, the subject is vulnerable and subject to problems along the way. So this becomes a very important, this is a very fundamental yisod. So that's the alkein. If it's a nice thing, what you said, Vahayla Basar Echad. Vahayla Basar Echad is an indication of the child, which Rashi says, in the child, because the objective of all this is to produce the child for procreation, which is part of the bracha for Ravu. But for Ravu, isn't that what he said? It's not just to think about bodies. It's for the advancement of civilization. So that's why Al-Kain, this now becomes possible. Because there is a being out there who does satisfy that need in a psychological way without creating the situation of dependency. So in order for man to be independent, he needs a mate. He needs an Azer connector.
And the next element over here is the story of the actual chait. As we said, this chait is different than all subsequent stories of sin, which the Torah recorded. So let's take a look at the parsha. Perek Gimel. It was very interesting. Pasuk Aleph, Va'nachash Hoya Aram, and the snake was literally naked. It's translated more in the sense of cunning. Mikol Chaya Chasara, from all of the animals of the field, Asher Asar Hashem Elokim, that the Lord God has made. Va'yomer El Ha'isha, and he said to the woman, Ah, Kiyamai Elokim, Osochu Mikol Eitz Hagan. I guess it's to be read in the form of a question. Ah, is it true? So to speak. Verification. Indeed, God said that you should not eat from all of the fruits, all of the trees of the garden. Now, what's interesting about Pasuk Aleph? Strange is that where's the snake coming into the picture? We haven't been told about the snake. All of a sudden, the snake, it takes it for granted that the snake is there, and we have not been introduced to the snake. Let alone the difficulty in the concept of a talking snake. And that's one element over here. Before the chait actually occurs, there's a dialogue with the snake. The snake seems to be involved. The snake seems to have an interest in having her eat from this forbidden fruit. I don't know why would the snake even be concerned about what she could eat and shouldn't eat. But I tell her, Isha Allah Nachash, and the woman said to the snake, Mikriyate Hagan Nochel, from the fruit of the trees of the garden, we may eat. Mikriyate Asher B'soch Hagan, but from the fruit of the trees in the middle of the garden, Omer Elokim, God said, Lo sochu mimenu, you may not eat from it. Lo sigu bo, ken tamusan, nor may you touch it, lest you die. Now her answer, of course, everybody knows this is very difficult. Pasuk Gimel, what's difficult about Pasuk Gimel? Yeah, you know there's a prohibition to add on, Lo sochu, you may not add on, or
take away from the mitzvot. Again, if you take a look at the story, it does not mention any prohibition against touching the tree. It merely says that they were prohibited. She's correct that we may not eat from it, but she adds on to it. And Rashi takes notice of this, that she added on to it. For Rashi, this is extremely significant. These words were crucial. According to Rashi, these words were crucial. Below Tiguvo. And had she not said that, according to Rashi, it does not seem that the outcome would have been the same. But Yomar Nachash El Ishan, the snake said to the woman, Lo mos temutim, you will not die. Ki yodea elokim, for God knows, ki v'yom acholcha mimenu, that on the day that you eat from it, v'nichtichu einechem, and your eyes will be opened, v'yisem kelohim, yodei tovarot. And you will be like God for the knowledge of the Torah. For the Rashi, Yisem Kelokim, Yotzrei Olamos, Rashi says. The Rashi is indicating something over here. According to Rashi, there was a desire to be a Yotzrei Olam, to be a creator. You will be like God, creator, you'll be creating your own world, so to speak. If you eat from this tree, Kevav is the actual commission of the chait itself. It begins with Vatera. She sees the eye. She tova eis lamachal. Then she goes into that state, that preliminary state which leads a person to actually commit the other. But this is all the preamble, so to speak, preparing the psychological groundwork. The snake. The story. This is the story of the snake, actually. So that's what we'll pause on to today. A big question: Why did the snake appeal to the woman? Why didn't the snake appeal to the man? But what is the most difficult thing of all is to locate some type of a framework to understand what is the snake? What's the snake doing over here? And what's its purpose? And who sent it here? And why is it interested? It's not a concern of the snake. All these issues don't seem to be snake-related issues. The Sfano, the Hanachash. Who's Satan? That is the Satan. This is a very important sforno, because we encounter the term of Satan very frequently in the Torah. And we always want to know what exactly is the Satan. Now, this is very important because people, you have to make a crucial decision. When you try and understand certain terms in Yaddish, you have to make a very crucial decision at this point with regard to the Satan. And most people tend to view it in a certain way. What am I referring to? What's the basic bottom line decision you have to make? Reality. Is the Satan a reality? An objective reality or not? Does it exist? Is there such a thing as a Satan? That's the crucial decision that you have to make at this point. Now if you decide that there is such a thing as a Satan, so that leads to all types of problems. I mean, when you say there is such a thing, of course, the Torah is speaking about something which is real, but most people mean that there's some force out there that you have to contend with, and that this force has certain powers over you, and you have to avoid it, and there's different things you do to avoid it. According to the Sforno, there's no such thing. Hu Satan, hu Yetzer Hara. This is the Yetzer Hara. So, according to the Sforno, we cannot take this part of the story literally. The story is to be taken literally, by the way. No one is suggesting that the Averi didn't occur. But the Torah here is using a certain mechanism to communicate some ideas, according to the Sforno. So who's talking to who? What mechanism is the Torah doing? The Torah here is using a literary device of exactly, personification. Taking an internal force, it's basically a battle is going on. A battle is going on between two forces within a Chava. And one of them is referred to as the Nachash, but it's really all Chava. She's going through a debate within herself. Before we answer that, why choose a snake as a medium, and also, why do this in the first place? Why is it using this method? Why not? She's different. She thought, she's, you know, to herself. The Torah, you know, a person, the Torah doesn't always do this when a person has thought. So, those are the two questions. I think that the point being made over here is to show that there's a difference between the essence. The conflict over here is between the essential components. The real essence, most people identify their essential self as being their emotional self. Their emotions are, they regard their emotions as being part of their essence. When they think of themselves, when a person thinks of himself as, you know, he has a certain self-image, a certain idea of what he is. And in most people's minds, their emotions are very much part of that. And the Torah here is showing that the emotion is really something else. The real essence of the person is the Selam Alakim. Is that component of man which is capable of knowledge and rationality, thought. And there's an opposing force. And you should view it as though it were a separate force. You should view the Yetzer Hara. The person doesn't view it that way. Yeah, he views everybody else's Yetzer Hara that way. But his own is different. His own is very close. It's very different. He treats it more with more warmth. And the Torah here, I'm not saying it's the only reason. I'm not saying it's the only reason. It doesn't make sense to take the chance. I'm just saying that's one factor, I believe. I can't say that that's the entire reason. I don't think I'll be able to say that. In other words, it's something we learn from this, okay? Rather than to say that this is why. It does depict the emotions of the Nachash as an adversary. It doesn't have to be. If a person can conquer, as we will see later on, that the objective, there's an Ava. There's going to be an Ava over here. That's when we get to the curses. There's going to be enmity. There's going to be an ongoing battle between you and the Nachash. And then you have the capacity to conquer the Nachash. True. And then, if you do so, you can utilize it. You can make it your servant. As we learned, you can serve God with the Yetzirah. That's what we discussed last week, if you remember. Okay, but now we turn to Kenny's question. And his question is, what is the reason for the selection of the Nachash to represent the Yetzirah? The Sfarno says, Rav HaHezek, does great damage, in Miut HaYoso Nira. Because of Miut HaYoso Nira. Its ability to hide. You don't see it. It's not visible. So therefore the snake is best suited to depict the Yetzirah. Can somebody explain it? Does great damage because of the fact that it's not visible. Yeah, it's very difficult for a person to know. If the Yetzer Hara is, that's why it's Aram, it's cunning. It has the capacity to make itself hidden, to hide. How? Because it always presents itself in a different light. It has the ability to hide behind some type of an idealistic motivation. So therefore, and it has a tremendous ability to rationalize, to find rationalization. So therefore, when a person finds himself wanting to do something, it's not that, and the underlying cause of the desire is the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara has the capacity to mask itself. It's hidden from view. It's not conscious. Moreover, it has the ability to attach itself to something which is very noble. So two things. First of all, it can hide. You don't even see it. That's first of all. But even if it doesn't hide, it's even worse when it becomes attached to itself to something which is an ideal. Then you're really in bad shape. Because as long as it's not hidden, there's some way out. In other words, if somebody should come along and show it to you, if you're an honest individual. All right, and you have some insight, or somebody will show it to you, somebody will help you, so then you can see it. But it's much more difficult when it's become attached to some ideal. Then you're a tzaddik, you're a fanatic. So, the alzeh derech, according to this manner, kara b'zeh ha-matom es ha-yetzara ha-machti, the Torah here is referred to the yetzara, which causes one to sin, Nachash. It's called it a snake, Biyoso Domala Nachash. In
in its similarity to a nachash. Asher to'alosa b'metzios ma'at ma'od who's to'elas. He has a different idea, by the way. Who's to'elas, whose benefit in existence is very minimal. The nisko rav and its nezek is great in muat haroso. Because of, he mentioned that point again. He has one other point though. He says that he says from a practical standpoint, the nachash is a good representation because the he says the nachash has very little benefit. Apparently, provides very little benefit. That's what he says. You have to explain that to me. To'alosa b'metzius ma'at ma'od. It's to'ela, benefit in existence is very minimal. The nisko rav, and its danger is great. What does that mean? What do you mean it's a benefit? I thought the idea was completely explained just by what was said. You're talking about the physical snake, then we're talking about the psychological snake, right? Okay. The physical snake, apparently he's saying, that I don't mind, I'm not going to argue with how important it is in terms of the whole system. That we can accept. Let's say we accept it, though. That it performs, it's not really that important to the world, whatever. It performs a little service. Well, let's assume that that's the case. That really isn't important. But why is that true with regard to the human, you know, Yetzer Hara? That's the question. I think he might mean it in this sense, in a general, I don't think he's going into all of the biological, how it fits into the whole biological system and all that. But in a practical sense, man doesn't derive, you know, other animals are derived benefit, like a dog has a certain purpose to watch dogs, cows and so on and so forth. You know, all these various animals have benefits. Like, you see? But a snake doesn't really perform much of a service. I think it's in the human framework. Yeah, there's no real benefit in having them. Right? They can cause a lot of damage. I think he means that. He's focusing on that point. Okay? Now, if that's the case, what does that mean with regard to the Yetzer? It's overestimated. I mean, the amount of... Most people are living their lives basically trying to promote the Yetzer. They're living their whole life based upon the Yetzer. The instinctual side. To gratify the instinct. Right? But the Toelas, all of the... If you think about it, all the labor, all the energy that's expended in trying to satisfy the Yetzer, and then you think of the toelas, the amount of benefit, it's very, very minimal. It's very minimal. The satisfaction that it provides is extremely minimal relative to the amount. Very temporary, very disappointing, as we've said many times. The toelas that it provides is a very fleeting one. And it takes a tremendous amount of work and he says, so therefore the benefit is minimalistic, and the danger is great because it's invisible, because of the invisibility, its ability to become invisible, to hide. It can hide. All right. Now, yeah, I'm sorry. That's the question. What do you mean, minimal benefit? Man was designed that way, and man couldn't function without it. If he didn't have the HRO, what would he do?
He
wouldn't be a human being. I mean, funny thing to say, he wouldn't be a human being. Isn't that one of the elements? But he other than Nefesh Chaya. The man was an instinctual being. It's part of his makeup. Unless you're saying that he would be something else. Then he would be more perfected being. He would be an angel. But that wouldn't be man. Of course, if that's the case. But we're talking about man. It's God's will that the Adam should exist as a human being, and that's the case, then instincts are essential. That's part of what defines them, part of the definition. It seems to be that most of whatever gets done in the world is basically because of emotion, as we said yesterday. Scientific progress and so on and so forth is essentially based upon emotions, underlying emotions. People want to get a name for themselves, they want power and so forth, so they channel, and that's a good thing. They channel their energy into a constructive project. The way the instincts have been designed in man, what saves the world is the fact that they can be satisfied through indirectly, through sublimated activities.
The instinct of aggression can be utilized properly. It's been responsible for the greatest progress, of course, for the greatest destruction too, but for the greatest progress. When it's channeled, when a person is embarked on trying to conquer the world intellectually, so that's a good thing. What does he see satisfying? His aggressiveness, right? But he's serving God. That's the way we explain the concept of serving God with the Yetzara. You take the instinctual energy and you utilize it for a good end. And if you take away all that energy, so what do you got? You got a guy sitting around looking out the window all the time, you know, not doing anything. I don't know what it means when he says, Havel HaMolam HaKolhevel. Yeah, it's not a bad association. But you're talking about the whole universe. It's all Hevel. It's all vanity. I think it does fit in, Mark. It's more in line with the explanation of the Sephora, that it's Ma'at Tolelos, it's nothing. But that statement itself is very difficult. I mean, what do you mean HaKolhevel? I think it will help us, though. It's a very good dissociation that Mel was making. Shlomo says, how long about vanity of vanity? It's all vanity. He's talking about the world. How can you say such a thing? It's God's world. It's a dear, here we're reading Bereshit. Why did God say it was good? Right? Why else did he tell it was good? It's God's world. What do you mean? Who is anybody to come along and say it's all vanity? Well, have we, and if so, I have to be included in Torah. Right? All the books of Nach, the same thing. They're all in line with the basic ideas of Torah. Otherwise, they would have been rejected. They would be heretics. How can you say something like that? He's not saying that that's the way imperfect people look at it. He's talking, it seems to be. He's talking, he's making a statement. It's his statement. Keep saying that. And Rashi said the Sheshim Eberation. That makes the question even stronger. And the Rashi indicates that that's a reference to the 6 days of creation. Okay, that's a big truth. A person does not see his own yitzhak. He's very good at seeing somebody else's yitzhak. It's extremely, it's unbelievable how a person can be very perceptive. It's extremely amazing. And then not only ordinary people, but psychologists. Good psychologists. Their whole, business is, that's an amazing point, how people are very adept at seeing other people's emotions, and yet when they have the same things, they don't see it, and they're going to the same type of denial. Psychologists in their own lives are known, it's a known thing, that they're not any more, perfected or better, and in terms of even raising children and so forth, do not have any better success than other people. Back to Mel's point about the connection between I think it's a good association. Good association in bringing up the statement of Kohelas, Havel, as a means of explaining the Sforno's point that the Yetzara as a Miyat Kohelas, as minimal benefit. And our question is, what do you mean by minimal benefit? It's part of man, and we wouldn't have human existence without it. So what does it mean by this point? Of course, this leads us into the question of Havel Havelon itself. As Avi points out, that the Rashi says is referring to Shesh Shemeh Bereshit, because of the amount of times Hevel is mentioned in that sentence, and he's referring to the 6 days of creation. So therefore, it seems to be a blanket condemnation of the world. Now, many pessimistic philosophers have expressed that type of viewpoint. But how can a man like Ohelas, that Shlomo Hamalach, who subscribes to all the views of Torah, how can he be contradicting that which God said is very good? You can't say that he's saying it's a vanity to understand it, because that's not what he's saying. Moreover, that would not be true, because that is one of the great things of that we should do. Hashemayim asap and provoke kale, the heavens declare the glory of God. I mean, we should try, and to the best of our knowledge, that's the mitzvah of Avos Hashem, to try and gain an understanding of the world. Yeah, well then I understand that. I mean, I think you'd have to be projecting that thought. If that thought were there, if that was stated, and then he would say that, right? But then he says that's not what he's saying. This would answer the question. That Kohelas was talking about the physical having that capacity that Levi is talking about, that it's a mirage. It appears the imagination as being good, and therefore a person chases after it. But the benefit that one gets is very minimal if one chases after it. However, in Bereshit, it's not talking about that. It's talking about the role of the instincts in terms of the ultimate good, which is the attainment of knowledge. In that respect, it's very good. When man was constructed to be an instinctual being, who had the tell and all the ten, see? That's a reference to the creation when everything in line with its true purpose. So that is very good. But Kohelet is talking about how people live their lives. And people live their lives on the basis of a big mistake. And that is they put all of their energy into the idea, into this fantasy of the instinctual enjoyment. They glorify it. And that is heaven. That's why there's no contradiction. So, this is the preamble to the Chet. The preamble to the Chet is this dialogue that goes on between the Chava and her Yetzer Hara. So let's see if we can understand it. Like Yomer Leisha, Ach Ki Yomer Lekem, Lo Tofu Mikolei Tadam. What is that? And it's like a question. Matomar Ishael Anachash, and the end of the pre-Eitzagon Nachel, she repeats something. The pre-Eitzagon Amar Lokim Lo Toklu Bimena. God said, you shall not eat from it far out. Now, but here, this should be a key opening. Lo Tifku Bo Ten Tenusim. Now, Rashi, let's see if we can understand. Let's just focus on the Rashi. Lo Sigu Bo. Take a look at Rashi. Rashi says, Lo Sifa Ala Sivui. She added on to the command, a little bit of zealousness. The figure of Baal is a Yiram. Therefore she came to a loss. If you add, it leads to a very, very important lesson, it seems to be. One shouldn't add on to the people. Husha Namar al Tosef al Dvara. That's what the Mishle says. Do not add on to his word. And the snake, and take a look at Rashi and Dal, Lomos Kamusan. So that is very interesting, Rashi. Rashi says, Dachba, the snake pushed her, Ashe Nogaba, until she touched it. This is what Rashi is saying. Again, this is not, I don't believe, to be taken on the literal level, but this is, she told the snake that, that if you touch it, will die. Then, she already set up her own doom, because now the snake started to push her. The snake started pushing her, maneuvering her, until she actually touched it. And then he said to her, Kishem she'ein misa b'negiya, just like there's no death in touching it, kach ein misa b'achila. So too there's no death in eating it. So therein lies a very important idea. Two Rashis. Okay? The first, we have to understand what's being said over here. What caused her to, did she make a mistake? What was the cause behind this? Her distortion of the command. Did she make a mistake? A legitimate one? And if not, what was the nature of it? And what role did it play in her downfall? Plus the case is difficult because all the Nachash is saying that on the days, when you eat from it, your eyes will be open, whatever that means, and you'll be like God for the knowledge of good and evil, which doesn't seem to be a bad thing. Rashi takes it to mean Yotzei Olamo, that you'll be a creator of worlds. We don't even know what that means. In what sense is she going to, and then where do we see afterwards that she would be a creator of worlds? What would be fantasy there? But on the plain level, all it's saying is you'll be like God, and which means you'll have knowledge of good and evil. Well, isn't that what man is supposed to have? Knowledge of good and evil? What's wrong with that? The Rambam takes up that very issue. So we'll leave that for the time being. What I want to focus in on for now is the idea that Avi's been talking about. This idea of adding on to the commandment. But that seems to have been problematic for him, and Levi has raised the question that there were why. We see that it's good to take precautions. We see that throughout the entire the rabbis came along and extended, make a fence. Asusiago Torah. Make a fence around the Torah. Now was she engaged in that or not? And how did that lead to her downfall? Oh, what he's saying is like this. Is that how a person relates to the achiever, to the object? In other words, is there something inherently wrong and evil about the object? Well, now, the only thing that makes it wrong is the fact that it's been prohibited by God.
and you do find, it's like it's true that it's a forbidden fruit. That once something becomes forbidden, the person is living in accordance with their emotions. Once something has become forbidden, then they attribute qualities to it. They can't tolerate the idea that they're being deprived of something. And that egotistical need to feel that I can have everything that I want, that comes into the picture, and it's precisely that thing which they lust after. It's basically the line that you're working with over here, I believe. Am I right, Avi? Yes. That could be a rational approach, and that is to say that we have to have certain restrictions. So whatever the case may be, so we have to restrict ourselves from certain things. And we should look at it in a rational way. Now, if that is the case, then we answer the question. And sometimes rationality demands that we take precautions. We add on, we make a fence around the world. But what you're saying is that this was not a rational making a fence around the world. This was a projection. It's a rational making a fence around the world, which is simply to say we shouldn't come near to it or whatever. But here she said that there's no difference between the touching and the eating it. We'll die by merely touching it. That means to say that there's something very special about this, and God doesn't want it to happen. So she added, which means it wasn't just an addition, but it was a distortion. Once she had a distorted relationship with Tzivi Hashem, she couldn't function anymore. The only way a person can perfect himself is when he has a rational relationship to the Tzivi. He views things in a rational way. A person has to maintain a system of control, a system of discipline, and therefore he has to forgo certain things. And once you have to forgo certain things, it's rational to take the precautions that are necessary. But once you corrupt it and you distort it, you make it into something having certain special qualities, and therefore you look at God as a father who's depriving you from certain experiences, like a childish kind of a thing, then you're looking at the situation in an entirely different way, and you're making yourself more vulnerable. You see? Because that part of you, which would, if you looked at it rationally, and you understood it in a rational way, you'd be able to control yourself. But when you're looking at it in that way, you're inexorably drawn to it. You're propelled to it. And maybe that's the concept that the snake pushed her, to break down the category. And when a person is operating, I know this happens, all this is in accordance with your interpretation, obvious interpretation. But there is truth there. I know a lot of people have a taboo attitude to people that aren't observant of Torah, but they've been raised not to eat like pork or something like that. And there are people, you always read about these people, totally assimilated the Jews. They'll always say, they'll talk about the first time they ate ham. You know, but why did they eat it? They were raised with the...
And they weren't fucking.
Yeah, exactly. They were raised with this powerful emotional repression. This is a horrible thing to do. And they couldn't overcome that. That's not a rational thing. But of course, then they were drawn to it. You see, they were drawn to it because they couldn't tolerate the idea that their freedom, their instinctual freedom, should have this limitation. So then now they're in a state of conflict. And then they'll say, well, they finally got themselves to do it, and they didn't, and they weren't struck down by lightning, so then the next time it became easier, and so forth. Yeah, that could be. That's the way I believe you're interpreting it, that the hate emerged from the fact that you didn't look at the commandments in a rational framework, but rather a certain emotion led it to project certain qualities onto the forbidden. And once you projected certain qualities onto the forbidden, so then she was drawn to it. She distorted it and she was drawn to it, and she lost that very mechanism which would have given her the capacity to protect. The only faculty which you have within you, which is that ultimately, and that's what you see a lot of people very often that you regard as being the most smart kind of people, that you find out that they could do the most unbelievable of error. Why? Because bottom line, it was an emotion. You see? And emotions can take a person to different extremes. In the world at large, very religious people can be crazy things, and even in Jewish, it doesn't really matter. I mean, it matters. I didn't mean to say that. If a person, in terms of perfection, a person is relating to the Torah system in a crazy way, he's not going to become perfected just because it happens to be the Torah system. Because it's better, but I'm just... In terms of perfection, it's how you relate to the Torah. So that's the point that's being made over here.
at least according to Avraham.
We're trying to get at basically is what is what's in place about the in the first faith. It's clear that this sin is different than all of the sins that come after it, because it effectuates some type of a change in the very nature of Adam Harishon. So we'd like to try and understand what his nature was like before the faith, and what took place as a result of the faith. Okay? Now, the Rambam writes about this in the Mora. Alright? Chapter 2 of the Gaon of Vilna. He says, some years ago, a learned man asked me a question of great importance. The problem and the solution which we gave in our reply deserve the closest attention. Then he goes into entering the problem, then he goes into some side points. Alright, that's the style in the Nora. Now he returns to the question. Just a few sentences I've skipped. It would at first sight, said the objector, appear from scripture that man was originally intended to be perfectly equal to the rest of the animal creation, which is not endowed with intellect, reason, or power of distinguishing between good and evil. But that Adam's disobedience to the command of God procured him that great perfection, which is the peculiarity of man, namely, the power of distinguishing between good and evil, the noblest of all the faculties of our nature, the essential characteristic of the human race. It thus appears strange that the punishment for rebelliousness should be the means of elevating man to a pinnacle of perfection to which he had not attained previously. In other words, the story makes it very clear that as a result of disobedience, they come into the knowledge, into the arena from which there was no good and evil. And it seems to us that the question is that is the mark of human perfection. That's what makes him different from everybody else, that he can distinguish between good and evil. These categories don't exist in the animal world. So what kind of punishment is it? This is equivalent to saying that a certain man was rebellious and extremely wicked, wherefore his nature was changed for the better, and he was made to shine as a star in the heavens. Such was the purport and subject of the question, though not in the exact words of the inquirer. Now mark our reply with what follows. Two points, I believe. One is that as a result of the chait, man was endowed with a new type of knowledge that he didn't have before, the knowledge of good and evil. Okay? Now, certainly at first glance, that seems to be something which indicates a very high level, something, some type of a perfection or a benefit. That's one part of the question. There's another part to the question, though. Kant says, in other words, part of this question is that it's not just saying that prior to the chait, man was barred from this arena of good and evil, and now he was given entree, and in his framework, that is a good thing. He goes even further, though, and he says that prior to the chait, man was basically just an instinctual being like any other animal. So for him, the essence is not just that he now has knowledge of good and evil, but that is important because that is what distinguishes him. In other words, that's what the question really meant. That he seems to be given some type of elevation. He's a totally different type of a being, and that is to say that since before the chait, he did not have the knowledge of good and evil, then you must say that he was no different than any other animal. He was a purely instinctual being. And as a result of disobedience,